Okay, good evening, everybody. Thank you so much for coming to learn together this evening in advance of Pesach, as we're going to try to discuss some inyanim related to Pesach. So I first of all, thank you, Tehila, for inviting me. And I asked Tehila what the topic should be. So she said, anything in Yanei Pesach. She said, I prefer halacha. Probably others prefer hashkafa. So I'm not sure which way to go with that. So I'll tell you what I have in front of me right here. I have a little bit of hashkafa, and I also have my notes from a shiur that I started to give earlier today in yeshiva. Yesterday I gave a shiur in yeshiva on the 10 most, I forgot what I called it, 10 most common shailas that rabbis are asked around Hilchos Pesach. So today I gave another shiur, and the title is going to be something like 10 most common questions rabbis are asked about Hilchos Pesach, or issues about Hilchos Pesach that come up. And I only got through like 4 of them today. So we could go through a number of other, what I think are interesting areas of Hilchos Pesach. We could do Ashkafa, we could do both. So by show of hands, I guess, all those who prefer straight halacha with zero Ashkafa, all those who prefer, there are a few, okay, all those who prefer straight Ashkafa with no halacha, and all those who prefer a little bit of each, okay. So we'll do a little bit of each, I guess. Okay, now if we do a little bit of each, should we start with Hashkafa or should we start with Halacha? I guess we'll start with Halacha since no one voted for just Hashkafa. So what I'd like to do is, like I said before, just to go through some of the questions that I didn't get to in my other shiurim over the past couple of days that I thought were interesting. What happened was yesterday I gave this shiur about the top 10 shailas that rabbis get around Hilchos Pesach, and I texted Rabbi Yaakov Taubes, who's a rav on the other side of the Heights, and he works with me in yeshiva, and I told him that that's the topic I'm giving shiur on. I said, do you have any suggestions? And he sent me, like, within 5 minutes, he sent me a list of 1 through 10 of the top 10 shailas that rabbis get, and only 2 of them overlapped with my 10. So I said, okay, this means there's got to be a sequel, there's got to be a part 2. So now I'm working through his list of the top 10 shailas that rabbis get. So one of the shailas that he mentioned, you know what, maybe I'll mention them and you'll tell me which one to talk about first. He asked, people are confused about time zones and Mechiras Chametz. I'm going to be in California, but my Chametz is in New York, or I'm going to be in Israel and my Chametz is in New York. Another one, he said, people are confused about quinoa. Can you use quinoa? Is it kidneys? Is it Chametz? Is it this? Is it that? Third one, about maror. Should people use horseradish for maror? Is that the real thing, or is lettuce the real thing when it comes to maror? Another one he suggested is how do we kasher kelim? What is the method through which we do hagalas kelim? Another one he suggested, a few relating to kasher and kelim that he suggested. Another one that he did not suggest, but it just occurred to me, was whether one is allowed to get a haircut or do laundry on Erev Pesach after Chatzos. I would say put that one in the category of not a shaila that rabbis get about Hilchos Pesach, but a shaila that rabbis struggle with about Hilchos Pesach, because every single year I go to Riverdale to do Mechiras Chametz on Erev Pesach, and up until the very last minute, it's just so busy. You're just running from one thing to the next, to the next, to the next. So never, and Sfira's coming up, so never have time to get a haircut beforehand. And then I come back from Mechiras Chametz and realize, oy vey, I still didn't get a haircut. Now I'm going to face 5 weeks without a haircut. And, it's usually right around Chatzos time. So in that last half hour before Chatzos, in Erev Pesach, you go to any barber shop, you'll find it full of rabbis. It's a shaila that rabbis themselves face, but it's an interesting shaila also. So any of those strike you as being somewhat interesting or not at all? Which one? Someone shout something out. The time zone one? Okay. So the time zone shaila is an interesting shaila, because when a person sells their chametz, it's very important that you do so in the right time. Meaning there is a time where it's too late to sell your chametz. Once the zman isur chametz, the Gemara says in Maseches Bava Kamma and elsewhere as well, in Maseches Pesachim, that there are two things that are not really in your rishus, that you are not really the owner of, of, but the Torah makes it as if you are the owner of it. Meaning, the Torah, for only to your detriment, the Torah considers you the owner of it. For example, if I were to go out into the middle of Audubon Avenue, right, that's the cross street here, and I were to take a jackhammer and just start jackhammering the street and making a giant bar in the middle of Audubon Avenue, so the halacha would be that if a car would then drive by and blow out its tire in the bar that I just made, in the pothole that I just made, I'd be chayiv to pay for that. So I could argue, well, I didn't do it, the pothole did it, and I don't own that pothole, it's Audubon Avenue, the city of New York owns that pothole, that has nothing to do with me, right? So it's not like my item didn't hurt you, something that belongs to the city of New York hurt you, so why should I have to pay for it? So the Gemara says that a bar b'rishus harabim is ainu b'rishus shladim. You're right, you do not own Audubon Avenue, you are not the owner of that street, but asa nakasav ki ilu ain b'rishuso, to your own detriment, in that you have obligations about it, we consider it as if it's yours. So if a car blows out its tire, you're obligated to pay for that tire. So we view it as if it's yours. And the other example, the Gemara says, is chametz misheishol selamayla. Chametz on Erev Pesach, once the Zman Isr chametz hits, it's not mine anymore. The Torah takes it out of my rishus. But asar nakasuv ki'ilu hu b'rishuso. It's as if it's in my rishus. And because of that, I no longer have the ability to sell it, because it's not mine anyway anymore. I can only sell things that are mine. But I'm still responsible for it. So the idea, so I would have to just destroy it. The only way to take care of my problem of Bali Rab Bali Matzei is by just destroying it. The time for Mechira is over at that point in time. You're not able to sell it anymore. Right? There are a lot of things that relate to chametz that people assume that the dinim that apply in Erev Pesach or before Pesach or the weeks leading up to Pesach are the same as on Pesach. This is true as far as how to get rid of chametz, and it's true as far as kashering is concerned. A lot of times people are, one of my more common questions I'm getting this year, because it's a long Chol HaMoed, is people are going to Airbnbs or to hotels just for Chol HaMoed, just time to get away for a few days. So they assume, oh, when I go to the Airbnb, I'll kasher the stuff that I need in the Airbnb. It doesn't work that way. There's a lot of things that you're allowed to kasher before Pesach that you're not allowed to kasher on Pesach. We're not going to get into the details of that right now, but getting rid of chametz is another example. When it comes to Erev Pesach, you can get rid of chametz through bittul, you can get rid of chametz through mechira. You can't do that on Pesach. On Pesach, you got to just destroy it. Now, it happens to be, if you have already sold your chametz before Pesach, then when you find it on Pesach, where it doesn't belong, it's not your chametz anymore. It belongs to the non-Jew who purchased your chametz from your rabbi. So in that case, we actually have a problem, because when you find chametz in your house on Pesach, if you did a mechira before Erev Yontif, you did a mechira on Erev Yontif before the Zman Iser, so when you find chametz in your house, whose chametz are you really finding? You're finding the non-Jew's chametz, because you already sold it to him. So if that's the case, if you want to go and destroy it, you are now stealing from the non-Jew. You're now taking his chametz. You're not allowed to destroy somebody else's stuff. So it would be a real problem. That's why each year at the Mechira, since we know people have a knee-jerk reaction that when they find chametz, they want to destroy it. It's not in the cabinet that's closed off. It's right here. What do? I remember one year in my parents' house, when my children were very, very young, so my mother bought in one of the from grocery stores in the Pesach aisle. She bought, you know, one of those kosher Pesach cereals, you know, that whatever, fruit balls or whatever they call it. You know, they're just one of these kosher Pesach cereals, and they're nasty, they're disgusting. No one would ever eat them, right? So we normally we would keep them from year to year to remind ourselves we didn't eat it last year, probably not going to eat it this year either. But one of them, my brother was serving the children cereal, and my brother's looking at the cereal and he's saying, This looks really good for Pesach cereal. You know, this is unusual. It said on the box, like, you know, Liebers or whatever, or Bloomies or whatever. You know, it was clearly a firm brand, right? So it was obviously Kosher Pesach. So, but it looks really good for Kosher Pesach cereal. So my brother looks at the ingredient panel and he says, cornstarch? That's kidneyous. Maybe this is only for Sfardim. And then he read the next ingredient, wheat flour. That's chametz. it turns out that all these companies make cereal during the year also. They say they usually sell it in Williamsburg. They don't sell it in the five towns in Teaneck, but they make cereal during the year also. And the grocery store had made a mistake, and they put that in the Pesach aisle. So here we had mamish chametz gomer right there on our hands on Pesach. So right away, my brother brought it out to the yard, to the backyard, and lit a fire and burnt the whole thing. But that's stealing. So Rabbi Willig is always machbid to always ask the Nachri. He says, listen, you're buying so much chametz from so many people. Sometimes a small amount of it might be found in a place where it doesn't belong. And when we find it in a place where it doesn't belong, it makes us very, very uneasy. So would you be mochel if we would burn just that tiny percentage that's not where it belongs? That's not where. And so far, every year, it used to be John Brown of blessed memory, who is no longer alive. You know about John Brown? John Brown is a legend in the Jewish community. He was the Nachri that Rabbi Willig sold chametz to since, I think, 1976. And John Brown always said that he believes that he's only lived so long. He retired at a young age because everyone in his family died in their 50s. So he assumed he was going to die also. So he moved upstate somewhere, and he just figured he would live out the last couple of years of his life there. And he kept coming back and selling chametz. And he was in his 80s already. And he said, I only live this long because of this mitzvah that I do, that I help the Jewish people with the selling of chametz. And like 30 rabbis would sell to him. He probably bought more chametz than just about any other non-Jew in the world. And when COVID hit, he couldn't come back. He couldn't come back to do the mechira. So Rabbi Willig had to do the mechira with somebody else. And that year he died. So, I don't know, maybe John Brown knew something. But so I always use the example, whenever I talk about a Nachri buying chametz, I always talk about John Brown, even though now it's someone else, it's not John Brown. So we'll just call that John Brown Jr. Although there is a John Brown Jr. But I totally lost my train of thought what I was saying. So the Nachri buys the chametz. We can only sell the chametz to him when we still have the rights to sell the chametz. Once the Zman passes, we don't have the rights to sell the chametz anymore. Once it's ready, the Zman Isru Chametz, I'm not able to sell my Chametz to him. So I remember once on Erev Pesach, I was going to a Siyum. There was a Bris. There was a Bris in the Young Israel of North Woodmere, which is across the street from my shul. And I was going into the building, and Rabbi Septimus, my dear friend, Rabbi Septimus, who's the rabbi of the Young Israel of North Woodmere, came over to me and he said, got a big problem. I just got a phone call from someone here who's in Israel for Pesach, and he just told me that he forgot to sell his chametz. So what does he do now? Meaning, his chametz is all in North Woodmere, but the person is in Israel. In Israel, it's 7 hours later. It's way past the Zman Isur Chametz already in Israel. So is he able to sell the Chametz? He forgot to, Rabbi Sabbath said, he forgot to make me a Shliach to sell his Chametz. So can I still do it? Can I still sell the Chametz? That's this Shaila. Meaning, do we look at where the Chametz is? Or do we look at where the person is when determining the Zman Isur? So what we do to get around this problem, typically, is that when anyone's in a different time zone, we do an additional sale of chametz the night before, meaning on the night of the 13th, the night of Bedikas Chametz, before Bedikas Chametz, before Shkia, we meet again in Riverdale, a much smaller group of rabbis, and we do a mechira then for anyone who's going to be in a different time zone. And that way, no matter where you are, by the time your Zman Isser comes, the mechira has already happened. And usually the people are, if they're in a different time zone, they've already traveled by that time. They're already not around their house at that time. They can't. It's too late to be going to Israel at that time. They've already gone to Israel by that time. So that's what we typically do. So, but Meikar Adin, when you can't do that or you haven't done that, what's the halacha? So Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva where the Shoel had told him that it's a machlokas between the Sefer Chesed Avram and the Yonah Yom Tov. And he said, I want to know, how do we paskin in this machlokas between the Chesed Avram and the Yonah Yom Tov? So Moshe Feinstein writes in Igros Moshe or Chaim Chilek Dalit Simon Sadi Dalit. He says Shnei Asvarim Chesed Avram v'Yonah Yom Tov Lori Isi. He says I've never seen those tshuvas that you're referring to, and this is very typical of Moshe Feinstein. Moshe Feinstein was the world's greatest expert in all of Shas, Bavli, Yerushalmi, Rambam, Shulchan Aruch, all the Nosei Kelim on the Shulchan Aruch, the major commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch, even the ones in really tiny print in the back of the Shulchan Aruch. He knew all of that by heart. He knew all of that literally by heart. He knew every Prima Gadim by heart. He was not interested in all the fancy new Svarim. He was not interested in reading all of the Achronim and knowing what everyone said. There are different styles of Talmidei Chachamim. Rav Vadya Yosef, if you put it in front of him, he read it. It didn't matter. It could have been written by his next door neighbor, by his next door neighbor's grandson, by his, big Talmud Chacham, little Talmud Chacham. He read everything. Rav Moshe wasn't really interested in reading everything. He was interested in reading really just the meat and potatoes, really just the basics. They say Rav Chaim Kanievsky, while he was more similar to Rav Moshe in that way, because he would always review all of Shas and every, Kol HaTorah Kula, the core of Kol HaTorah Kula, every year, that someone told me, I was talking to Chassidus Talmud Chacham last week, and he told me that Rav Chaim Kanievsky's grandson said that he would spend 5 or 10 minutes every day flipping through the Svarim that people brought him that day. Meaning, people would come to visit him, so everyone who writes a Sefer, every Mechaber Sefer, would bring him their Sefer. So every day he's getting 30 new Svarim, so what's he going to do with them? So he would spend 5 or 10 minutes flipping through the 30 Svarim that he got that day. And this Chassidus Talmud Chacham told me he knew that because he brought Reb Chaim a Sefer, and then 2 years later he came to Reb Chaim, and he said his name, and Reb Chaim said, the Sheinah Svarim, that you write those sweet Svarim. And he said, how did he know? So Reb Chaim he wasn't good with names, but he was good with names of authors of Svarim. So that he could do. So he immediately remembered. So he said, yeah, because he flips through the pages. I have a picture in my office of Reb Chaim holding my first Sefer. My son brought him my first Sefer. And I always comforted myself by saying, there's no way he ever opened it, because that would be mortifying if I thought Reb Chaim ever opened the Sefer. But now I'm a little nervous, that he opened it. But anyway, so Reb Moshe says, I don't know these Svarim. I don't know what, that's not my style of psak, to go looking around in all these Svarim and telling you. Rav Shachtet said a lot of times Reb Moshe would write a whole tshuva, and then he would give the tshuva to Rav Michal Birnbaum, who was Mashkiach in MTJ, and he would say, tell me if any of the Achronim say anything about this, because he was never interested in, he never read the Achronim. So Michal Birnbaum would say, yeah, there's no Debi Yehuda about this, there's Rebbe Kivager about that, and then Reb Moshe would just add in an extra paragraph, that even though the no Debi Yehuda and Rebbe Kivager say differently, this is still what I think. But he felt that if it was a major Achron, he had to mention it. So in this tshuva, Reb Moshe says, I don't know which story you're talking about, but I'll tell you, Hanacholna Anias Daiti, Va'akuntra Shiyotze L'pamim Me'ashiva B'Shem Torah V'ara. He says, I wrote an article in a journal called Torah Vahora'a, She'ikr l'dina l'inyan y'isr bal yira'a v'aseid t'ashbisu shu'rak ala gavra. He says, when it comes to the isra of owning chametz, when it comes to the mitzvah of destroying chametz, it's a din on the gavra, it's a din on the person. That if the person is in a medina, is in a place where it's still not the zman isr, then he has no isurim or chiyuvim yet. But as far as the isra hana'a, we are machmir even for the makom where the chametz is. Wow, that's an interesting thing. As far as the isra of destroy, as far as the isra of owning the chametz, the mitzvah to destroy the chametz, we look at where the person is. As far as the isra hana'a from the chametz, we look at where the chametz is. Why? Why would you distinguish? So he says, very interesting. Vatam, who de kamod de mashma de gam chametz shel katan vav shel cherish v'shota ne'asru bahana'a. He says, because the halacha is that chametz that belongs to a katan, chametz that belongs to a cheresh, a shota, people who are not chayiv in mitzvos whatsoever, is asur bahana'a. Well, whose isur is it? A cheresh, shota, katan have no isurim, they have no mitzvos. So whose isur is it? Elamai, you see that it's an isur in the chametz, that it's a din in the chametz. So you see that relates to the chametz itself, as opposed to the mitzvah of biur and the isra of bal yira, that relates to the person. So again, the way we deal with this, and Rav Moshe points out, he says, "Olchein lemaisa, since you're in Eretz Yisrael, yimser bar Yisrael chametz al yidei ma sheyas a shliach l'rav haosik b'zeh limkar chametz l'nachri to kodim zman ha'iser aval yomer beferish l'rav a shliach she'enu osiyo shliach liklos b'chazar es chametz achar pesach." Meaning, one might say, very simple, go to a rabbi in Israel and sell your chametz there. And the rabbi in Israel will sell it before the Zman Isser in Israel. No, but the problem is, he also might buy it back before the Zman Isser before the Zman Heter returns in America. And if you're trying to be machmir on both ends, and you want to make sure that you don't reacquire this chametz on Pesach, you want it bought back later on. So that's why the rabbi should say, and I'm not buying it back right away, I'm buying it back later on. So when we do this mechiras yud gimel, when we do the mechiras chametz early, we make it clear that the chametz is only being purchased back at right after Yontif, like the regular Mechira. It's only being purchased back at a later time. And we do that even with the regular Mechira. We say there are some people that are going to be in Arizona, or they're going to be in Los Angeles, and it's going to be 3 more hours of Yontif before they're allowed to have their Chametz back. So we'll say we're going to do a Maisa Kinyan right now with John Brown, and we're going to buy back, of blessed memory, we're going to buy back the chametz from him right now, but the chalos of the kinyan for those people who are in those time zones, it should only be chal. The kinyan should only take effect time later. So that's what we do as far as chametz. It's in a different time zone. Okay, good. That's question number one. Question number two. Maybe we'll do one or two more, and then we'll go into the hashkafa. So what do we want to do? We want to do kinwa, we want to do maror. What's your preference? Maror? Okay, so let's do maror. As far as maror, so when I was growing up, I was always under the impression that if you are a real Jew, you eat horseradish, that white stuff, for maror, and if you are a wimp, then you eat lettuce for maror, because you can't handle what they would call the real maror. So it took me till I was in Rav Shach Tashir in YU to learn that the Mishnah says otherwise, and the Halacha says otherwise. It is abundantly clear in the Mishnah that the real maror is lettuce. The real maror is the romaine lettuce. The fake maror, or the second-rate maror, that's not as good as lettuce to use, is horseradish. Why is that the case? So let's go through the sugya a little bit. The Mishnah in the second paragraph of Maseches Pesachim lists 5 vegetables that you're allowed to use as maror. The assumption is they're listed in order of preference. That's what all the poskim assume, that 5 vegetables in order of what's the most preferred to use for maror. So it says names of vegetables: chazeres, ulshin, tamcha, charchavina, and ironically the last and least preferable one on the list is called maror. So, for whatever reason, right? So, those are the names of the vegetables. So, now, you just have to figure out what each vegetable is. So, chazeres is number one on the list. So, the Gemara says, what is chazeres? The Gemara says, chasa. Chazeres is chasa. Chasa is the modern Hebrew word for lettuce, and there's very little doubt that that the Mishnah, when it refers to chazeres, is lettuce. What's the big problem with saying that lettuce is the maror that reminds us of the bitter shibud of Mitzrayim? What's the problem with that? Lettuce is delicious, right? I have lettuce for lunch every day. I mean, together with other vegetables and some sliced grilled chicken and some dressing. But still, lettuce is delicious. It's crunchy, it's delicious. There's nothing wrong with eating lettuce. So why on earth would they have had lettuce for maror? So it's probably, so, you know, people say, well, if you let lettuce rot, it then tastes bitter. Yeah, if you let anything rot, it tastes bitter. It's hard to assume that that's the reason that lettuce is considered maror. So lettuce is a winter plant in Israel, and clearly in the Middle East, that's what was available around Pesach time, and it makes the most sense that chazeres means lettuce. Israel's wild lettuce, the regular lettuce that grows in Israel, not in the greenhouses and not, you know, the wild lettuce that used to grow in Israel in the Middle Ages and probably still grows in Israel in certain places, does not look or taste like the Andy Boy, romaine lettuce that you buy in Costco or wherever else. It has a stalk in the middle, and it has loose and very prickly dark green leaves, and it still grows today in Eretz Yisrael. That type of lettuce, that brand of lettuce, is very bitter, especially as it ages. And when its stalks get cut, it oozes some amount of white bitter sap, meaning it's actually full of some amount of bitterness that's, if you taste it, you would taste significant bitterness when you have that lettuce. The question then becomes, so how broad is the category of lettuce? Meaning, if that's the lettuce that the Mishnah was talking about, so almost all poskim assume that it also includes romaine lettuce. Question is, does it also include iceberg lettuce? Because what's the downside of using romaine lettuce for maror? Now, romaine lettuce can be infested. A lot of times people don't have time on Erev Pesach to be cleaning every last leaf and looking for all the bugs and taking care. So it could be infested. So iceberg lettuce is much less infested. Very rarely will you find a bug in iceberg lettuce. So they say, I think that Rav Aaron Cutler used to have iceberg lettuce for Marah, because he held that iceberg lettuce is included in the category of Marah, and he was nervous about the bugs. He was nervous about, you know, violating the Yisurim D'Oraisa of eating insects. So that's a question of just how far beyond the basic type of lettuce that grew in Israel it goes, but all the poskim seem to assume that it includes romaine lettuce. Romaine lettuce is an ideal vegetable to use for Marah. The second item on the list is olshin, which everyone agrees is endives. So endives are also kosher to use for Marah. Anyone know anyone who ever used endives for Marah? Yeah, people do? Okay, is that, okay, good. Is it a Sephardic thing? What? Okay, so good. So that certainly, so you could argue that it's better than the lettuce because we know what an endive is, and the lettuce that we have is not the lettuce that grew in Israel, and it's second on the list. So it's the next one up. Certainly in Mediterranean countries, endives and lettuce were always used for Marah, and it's still used for Marah. Lettuce is more common than endives, but apparently endives is also used. Now, Jews in Northern and Eastern Europe didn't always have access to lettuce, because they were in very cold climates and lettuce couldn't grow in cold climates. In fact, the only things that they did have were like root vegetables, things that were growing in the ground. So you know what's a root vegetable? Horseradish is a root vegetable, right? It grows in the ground, and that they always had access to. In modern Hebrew, horseradish is called chazeres, which is funny because chazeres is the first item on the list, but we know that's not what it means. Chazeres means lettuce. Tamcha is often understood by poskim, which is the third item on the list, is often understood by poskim to mean horseradish. That we assume that that's what's referred to by tamcha. Horseradish is mentioned by the Rokeach and by some other Rishonim, but not in the context of Marar. It's mentioned first in the context of Charoses, that it used to be an ingredient in Charoses, which gives you the impression that we're doing Charoses all wrong. Meaning, if you would put horseradish in the Charoses, your Charoses would taste nothing like the Charoses that we eat. We're probably doing Charoses all wrong anyway. Because one thing that the Gemara says that's supposed to go into Charoses is tapuach. What is a tapuach? What's a tapuach? You know that it's a trick question, that's why you're not answering. Yeah, so tapuach is in modern Hebrew, is an apple. Rav Shachter often points out, and he writes in his second Sefer, Bikvei Hatzon, that tapuach, and that Tosus writes, he just quotes Tosus writes, that tapuach does not mean an apple. That tapuach in Middle Eastern countries, they didn't have apples in those times. They had citrus fruits. Citrus fruits grow in those kinds of climates, and tapuach means a citrus fruit. And that's why the Gemara says that you should make the charoses somewhat acidic, like a tapuach. So you add tapuach to make it somewhat acidic. Tapuach means a citrus fruit, some lemon, some orange, something like that. So we put apples in our charoses for the most part. Most people put apples in the charoses, so we're probably getting our charoses all wrong anyway. The fact is that horseradish may not be any of the items listed on in the Mishnah, and the only reason people use horseradish is because they didn't have any of the items listed in the Mishnah. So Shlomo Zalman Orbach was asked about this, that maybe people should stop using horseradish because it's not listed in the Mishnah. So because according to the what we're able to understand now, it doesn't seem to be the identity of tamcha. So Shlomo Zalman said, no, we have traditions and we follow our traditions. And if that's what your Babi and Zaidi ate, and that's what their Babi and Zaidi ate, so that's what you eat, and you don't have to worry about it at all. However, it seems much better not to rely on that which is probably a mistake, or that which was initially adopted as a real b'dieved, as a real situation where they didn't have anything better. So therefore, it's probably better to use lettuce. The one who really brought horseradish to the masses and really made it okay was the Chasam Sofer. The Chasam Sofer has a tshuva in Aruch Chaim Sim Kuf Lamed Beis, and it's quoted in the Mishnah Brura in Siman Tafayin and Gimel Sif Katan Mem Beis, that that it's better not to use lettuce because it gets so buggy, and you don't want to violate Nisa Daraisa just to enable yourself to perform what is a mitzvah derabanan bizman hazeh. Even though the Torah does say that you have to eat maror, the Torah only says that in the context of Karban Pesach. Al matzos marom yachluhu. There's no independent mitzvah of eating maror, and since there's no independent mitzvah of eating maror nowadays, maror is only derabanan. There's only one mitzvah sachila midaraisa that we still have, and that's matzah on the night of the Seder. We lost the mitzvah so far without a Beis HaMikdash of Achilas Kachim, of eating karbanos, of Achilas Truma, of Achilas Maaser Sheni B'Yerushalayim, of all the other mitzvahs Achilas. There's no mitzvah to eat any particular item. Jelly donuts on Chanukah is just a minug, if you could even call it that. It's not Hamantashina and Purim. There are no mitzvahs Achilas. We don't have anything. We don't have any mitzvahs Achilas left except for matzah. So that's what the Chasam Sofer suggested. So it would seem, Rav Shachter often points out though, that what some people like to do is they want to feel like they're feeling bitterness, but they also want to have the right thing. They want to have the lettuce, which is the more correct vegetable. So what do? They'll stick some horseradish in the lettuce. So Rav Shachter points out, that's probably not the smart thing to do, because if you hold that the horseradish is real maror, then it's fine. The different minim could be mistarif with each other. But in all likelihood, horseradish is not one of the items on the list, and it was only used because we had nothing else. So if it's not one of the items on the list, you're actually having a different condiment on your maror. And that you're not allowed to do. You're not allowed to put other things on your maror, because that's going to be mevatel, the tam of the maror. It's going to take away the tam of the lettuce, which is the real maror. So even though there were those that didn't like the idea of using lettuce, I think Chazanish was among them, because he thought it's too sweet and it's not going to give you that sense of bitterness. Most poskim assume you don't need to taste bitterness, you need to taste maror. And whatever that vegetable tastes like, that's what you're supposed to have. So therefore, it's probably better to have lettuce. Another reason why it's better to have lettuce is that it is very difficult for people to eat a kazayas of horseradish. It tastes awful. And so people will often have just a little bit, and then they didn't do the mitzvah sachila. The Rush writes that the reason you have to have a kazayas of maror is because you recite a bracha, Asher kidushanu b'mitzvos v'tzvanu al achilas maror. The word achila means a kazayas. If you're not going to eat a kazayas, then you didn't really do achilas maror. So you, not only didn't you do the mitzvah properly, you said a sheker, you said a lie, and probably a bracha levatalo also. So that would be terrible. So it's important to have a kazayas, but to have a kazayas of horseradish, if it's really strong stuff, could land you in the hospital. So you don't want that either. For those reasons, it's probably better to use lettuce. So that there are other reasons as well, but those are the primary reasons that I'm thinking of right now why it's probably better to use lettuce, to make sure you have a kazayas. A person should realize that both men and women are chayiv in all the mitzvos of the Seder, including all the mitzvos achila. So there's no such thing as like, okay, let the men, you know, tough it out and try to have a kazayas of maror, and I'll just have a little bit of something. No, a woman is also obligated to eat a kazayas. So much better to l'chora, much better to use the lettuce for maror. Now, if you have a family tradition not to do that, and it's not being served at your seder, okay. So what can you do? You follow your family traditions. But it seems that it's much better option. Any questions on that? No. Yeah. What's that? Is it a violation of gebrux, you're asking, of matzah shriya, to have korech, to have horseradish? So as long as it's not mixed with any water, it's not, because the minug of gebrux is not to mix matzah with anything that can cause further chimutz. But natural ground vegetable, even if it's somewhat wet, we don't assume causes any further chimutz. So I assume they do use horseradish for korech. Gotta use that. Also, horseradish is pretty dry usually. So I think they do use it. I mean, the horseradish that we get, you know, that we use for our gefilte fish, that's mixed with beet juice and beets and other things, and vinegar and other ingredients. But if you just take the horseradish root and you grind it up, it's pretty dry. You don't really have an issue. Generally speaking, May peiros, you have to be pretty machmir about kabrax to be machmir about May peiros also. Because we assume May peiros, what's the concern about kabrax? That someone is concerned that there's a pocket of flour that was never really baked in the matzah somewhere. And now if that pocket of flour comes in contact with water, it's going to turn into chametz, right? Or that maybe there's a thin layer of flour on the surface of the matzah. Like in the matzah bakery, they had all these matzahs out, then they opened up a new bag of flour. You ever open up a bag of flour and the whole thing just like, it goes all over the place. So it could be that some of the flour just lands on the matzah. So if you have fresh flour on the surface of your matzah and you stick it into water, that could immediately start a chimutz process. The halacha is that mei peiros cannot make something into chametz. Only water can make something into chametz. Mei peiros can make it into chametz nuksha, but not real chametz, not chametz gamur. So the whole thing is such a chumra to begin with. But then to even be machmir about mei peiros is a chumra al gabe chumra. Now there are chassidim that are very, very, very machmir about this. There are many people that will not even eat matzah over their table, lest there be some moisture somewhere on the table. They eat matzah over the side of their chair. Anyone ever seen this? They'll eat matzah over the side of their chair so that the crumbs get all over the floor, but nothing on the table. And then the whole rest of the meal, there's no matzah on the table. So people do take it to extremes. I personally cannot imagine a Pesach without matzah pizza, but there are people that can imagine it quite well, that there's no liquid whatsoever that comes into contact with the... by the way, recommendation, if you can get your hands on Sfardi matzah pizza, that's the way to go. It's almost like real pizza. Okay, so. So we do tell them which house it is, meaning we have it marked on the on the shtaros, on the shtar harsha, like who's where, so that they can know. In fact, there are some rabbis that will sometimes bring the nachri into someone's house on Pesach, just because, make it real. I think Rabbi Orlian once did it in Lawrence, that the guy said, yeah, I'd like some chametz now, I'd like some Cheerios, and he brought him into someone's house, and he had himself, he took himself a couple of Cheerios, and whatever, and that was, it's a good thing to do every once in a while, so I think I remember hearing that story that Rabbi Orlian did in Lawrence. Okay, so time to switch to Ashkafa? Yeah. Anyone has opinions? Yeah, okay, all right.